Now to John Trowbridge, who's going to look at professions and the regulator. John's been a member of the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority, APRA, since 2006. He spent the larger part of his career as a consultant, having founded Trowbridge Consulting in 1981, a firm which became a leading actuarial and management consulting firm during the next 20 years, and which merged with Deloitte in 2000. He previously worked with the Commonwealth Treasury in the Government Actuaries Office, and had also held senior executive positions with QBE Insurance. After completing his consulting career in 2002, he led Suncorp's insurance business for a period and was subsequently a local director of Munich Reinsurance. He was president of the Institute of Actuaries in 1998, served as a member of the Treasurer's Financial Sector Advisory Council from 1998 to 2004, was awarded the Centenary Medal in 2001 and was named Actuary of the Year in 2006. He was appointed to the Financial Reporting Council in April last year and is a member of the Executive Committee of the International Association of Insurance Supervisors. Among John's responsibilities at APRA is carriage of the current initiative on executive remuneration. Good luck and welcome. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Peter, and good morning to you all. I'm pleased to talk to you about, I find how the slides work. There we go. I'm going to talk to you about the GFC, the regulator, and the profession. By the profession, I refer here to the actuarial profession. By the regulator, I'm thinking predominantly of the prudential regulator. And the GFC, for those of you who live in Melbourne, I need to tell you that it's not the Geelong Football Club, it's actually the global financial crisis. Currently we seem to have a pause. The liquidity problems in the banking system have been reduced. Stock markets appear to be a little more stable. Interest rates have come down and are beginning, I think, to do a job. And there seem to be fewer corporate bad news stories around just at the moment than we've seen over most of the last year. So it's something of a chance to reflect on what has happened and what might happen next. There's a legacy from the global financial crisis. Whatever the causes of it were, or whatever your analysis of it is, we are left with quite a legacy today. Banking systems around the world are limping along with, in most countries, some form of government support. And I notice, Alden, you didn't refer, when you talked about government, to the terrific amount of support that the deposit guarantee and wholesale funding guarantee are giving in Australia. But why is this happening? It's because the combination of institutions themselves, prudential regulation, and central banks was not powerful enough to respond to the pressures that developed in 2007 and 2008. The high leverage is now being... So we see high leverage, it's being unwound. In the United States, it ran up alarmingly over the last 20 years, and I think it's something like four times GDP a year ago from only two times 20 years ago. So there's an awful amount of deleveraging to come in front of us. We've seen reduced or falling asset prices, and we're now seeing many secondary effects from the high leverage and those high asset prices. Systemic effects have been extreme and, of course, are now spilling over strongly into the rest of the economy. The economic recession is evident through rising unemployment, low interest rates, falling profits, rising insolvencies and so on. So we have questions of many kinds: systemic, institutional, role of government, nature of regulation, all through this period of stability and instability and upheaval. Well, I'm now going to talk about the regulatory response. And I'll talk about it in two parts. There's a direct reaction to the crisis, which we're all trying to deal with now. I'd call that the crisis response. And then there's preparing for next time, which is the structural response to this crisis. I'm going to concentrate on the structural response, but there are lessons in the crisis itself and responses to it so far. If we have a look at these three items, what you see, I've got agency here, government and central bank, The government is essentially responsible for fiscal policy and the central bank for monetary policy. Together, they are very active in trying to manage the economy, and system stability is a primary responsibility of the central bank, and it's also part of the role of the prudential regulator. Institutional stability is a major role of the prudential regulator. Note in particular the role that governments are playing, which is essentially to resolve the thrift paradox, which I think Alden was alluding to, a liquidity problem when everybody wants to turn everything into cash, the economy gets jammed to a standstill, and system interests and individual interests, which normally coincide where sellers find equilibrium with buyers, no longer do. Everyone's a seller. So you can, that's sort of what we got to. As to the structural response, there is nothing yet that's really happened, but there are numerous announcements, papers and reports in recent months. There are also numerous statements about the causes and the prognosis and many ideas to avoid or mitigate future problems of this kind. Just to illustrate, reports or papers relating to regulatory reform include, in April last year, the Financial Stability Forum report on market and institutional resilience. It was an interesting G30 paper, mainly about the US banking system in January this year. Adair Turner, chairman of the FSA in the UK, made a speech also in January. There was the Andrew Haldane speech from the Bank of England in February. The De La Rosière report about reforming regulation within Europe was released in March. The full Turner report was also released in March. That's a blueprint for the UK and for global regulation. This month we've seen the G20 communique and also the Financial Stability Forum report on pro-cyclicality. And I can't go without mentioning Mike Barker's very interesting paper that he's presented just today. A major question arising through all of this is about pro-cyclicality or positive feedback. How do we reduce it? And it's given that we've had not just institutional failures but systemic failure, we've had debilitating consequences. A widely put proposition is that regulatory weaknesses and corporate risk management weaknesses have amplified rather than attenuated or dampened the effects of the original US subprime crisis and CDO excesses. So the regulatory response, or the calls for regulatory response, are around things like integrity of regulation, effectiveness of group regulation, capital requirements, accounting standards, pro-cyclicality questions, credit rating agencies, models, structured products. There's a lot of suggestions around about what to be done, what should be done. Well, what is wrong with today's regulatory arrangements? We need to look at system stability, systemic risk, institutional stability and institutional risk, all of those things. There are two assumptions, as I see it, by most politicians, bureaucrats and commentators. The first assumption is that current regulation is inadequate, and the second one is that changing the regulations will solve the stability and the institutional problems. My view is that regulation is indeed inadequate in some countries, but changing the regulations will deal with only one dimension of a four-dimensional problem. The four dimensions are business and regulatory cultures, regulatory agency structure, regulation itself, which is what everybody is focusing on, and supervision that's undertaken by regulators. On the subject of business and regulatory cultures, to illustrate the point, just think, in 2007, there was a massive, we were coming to the towards the end of a massive campaign, if you like, to see deregulation, to reduce regulation. It was especially so in the United States, but we had a red tape task force here and so on. The idea was let the market rule and reduce all that useless and stifling regulation. Let me illustrate this further by reference to regulatory agency structure. To begin, looking at Australia, we have a Twin Peaks model, ASIC and APRA, one specialised regulator for prudential regulation and one for market conduct. We have a single agency which is national, and it covers, for our purposes today, banking and insurance. It also covers superannuation, and its prudential focus is specialised. If you have a look at the UK, we have something slightly different. We have a single agency, but it is national, same as here. It is integrated across the industries, but the prudential focus of the regulator is shared with the market conduct focus. In the United States, we have a single agency. There is fragmented scope of agencies. There are 50 insurance regulators, but there are also about half a dozen banking regulators of different kinds, and it's quite unclear if you look closely at where there's overlap and where there's underlap, but there is certainly fragmentation, and that's part of the cause of the problems I think we see today. It also is not integrated across industries. Each regulator deals with one industry, and their prudential focus is also shared in most of those regulators with market conduct regulators. What about regulation itself? That's where everybody's focusing attention, and the main issues are around the quality and the scope of the regulation, which is around things like capital, risk management, governance, and financial reporting. Supervision is about the quality and effectiveness, supervision. What's important about supervision is its quality and effectiveness. In APRA, we send teams of people in, as most of you know, to review what regulated institutions do, and we have a very big investment in that. But it is expensive to do, and it's resource intensive. By my observation, in my limited time as a regulator, the quality and depth of supervision is the major distinguishing feature between the regulatory regimes that work well and the regulatory regimes that do not work so well. Let me illustrate. If you have a look at the distinguishing between regulation and supervision, I know in Australia we have an implemented regulatory regime about groups and about individual companies in insurance and in banking. In the UK, there's no real regulatory structure around groups in insurance or banking. There is some, but I don't think it's complete in the way ours is. In the USA, it's unclear whether banking regulation has worked. That's the question mark there under solo banking. There is no group regulation in the US of insurance, and it's unclear whether there is an effective regime in banking. For supervision, I'm quite confident that we do a good job of it in APRA, both at the solo institution level and at the group level. The FSA in September of 2007 lost the Northern Rock, so to speak, and they did an internal audit review, which is really a mea culpa, and it's got some quite clear... They published their review, many of you would have seen it, and they clearly stated there that they had to do a lot more around the supervision, around prudential supervision. So I think, without offering you any views I have, and my knowledge is quite limited, of exactly how and how well supervision is done in the US and the UK, I would like to suggest that going for gold, for any of you here who are part of an international consulting organisation, would be to do an independent comparative study of the quality of supervision, as distinct from the quality of regulation, in these three countries and perhaps others, to try and understand fully, and for the political and regulatory community around the world, and perhaps for the industries too, just what is good supervision, what is effective, and what isn't. My hypothesis is that is an important part of why we're where we are today, but I don't really know that, and I think it'd be very interesting to find out. Another distinguishing feature, by the way, is the nature and effectiveness of group regulation. In the US, there's wide recognition that the AIG problem, which is a triumph, in fact, of solo supervision, demonstrates clearly what can occur when there is not effective group supervision. In groups, you have contagion risk of various kinds around capital measurement, intra-group transactions, unregulated entities, governance and risk management, and financial reporting. So there's a lot in the group situation. Well, let me turn now to the role of the actuarial profession in the global financial crisis, and I've got one going for goals suggestion for the profession too. The question I'm looking at is how the profession might need to position itself into the future and the capabilities required. The role of the profession to date in life and general insurance, we've played our normal role in abnormal circumstances in the last year or so. Direct effects of the global financial crisis on insurance are limited largely to poorly performing assets, which on the whole in Australia have not been particularly problematic. That's certainly true in general insurance. It has generated some stress in the life insurance industry, but due to the structure of the portfolios of our life companies in this country and the way in which superannuation has developed and so forth, there's rather less stress on our industry than in many countries overseas. The indirect effects have, of course, produced stress, the rapid falls in interest rates, the increases in spreads, and some of the other consequential effects which are running through the economy are starting to have their effect. But, of course, there's much more severe stress on the banking system. And our profession has played a limited role and overall no statutory or regulatory role in the banking system. As for our role in insurance, our professional independence, I think, has been valuable with our membership of the Institute, the Code of Conduct, professional standards and so on. It's been highly valuable to boards, to senior management and to the regulator. With the actuary standing between management and the regulator, contributing to the integrity of the accounts, especially the balance sheet, and to analysis of the financial position and quality of risk management, I think there's a very important function that the profession is contributing. And there's even more to go, I'm sure. Even accounting standards are within the actuarial domain in responding to the GFC. And perhaps, as time goes by, there might even be more asset valuation responsibilities, depending in part on what happens with accounting standards around fair value and some of the other issues associated with valuing assets. Actuaries have been contributing to pricing and the pricing discipline. And in all these areas, actuaries have been using judgment and providing in-house professional advice. When I say in-house, I mean could come from outside, but it's professional advice which is of an independent nature being supplied to boards and management. And in fact, we don't really have anything to that's equivalent to that in the banking industry. We do, of course, in defined benefit super funds. Insurers already benefit from the actuarial role, and I think the best recent kudos for the profession in Australia, which can be shared between the profession and APRA, is the success of the financial condition reports in general insurance. They are now widely appreciated and indeed lauded by many directors of insurance companies, notwithstanding earlier scepticism and, as many of you know, quite considerable opposition from some parts of the insurance industry. But in the banking industry, there is no such professional intermediary role. Boards and the regulator have to rely on the accounting profession, because the banks follow accounting standards. Accountants are not expected to assess liabilities or make judgments on asset values on the whole, and nor do they undertake the types of analysis that actuaries do. Let me move on to the pro-cyclicality debate. It's largely about provisioning, not exclusively, but there's an awful lot about this. And an interesting question to think about is whether the situation in the banking industry could have been any different if actuaries had had an established role in banks before this whole thing started. The accounting standard for banking says, in effect, that known losses, not expected losses, can be put into the balance sheet. I think banks could be a little more proactive there in putting a little more into their balance sheets, but the generally they haven't done so, and that's to some extent one of the pro-cyclicality problems.
3 minutes, John. 3 minutes.
Okay. There are a lot of questions about capital modelling and other forms of modelling, and it's usually not the models themselves which are the causes of problems, but the quality of the data and assumptions and the understanding of limitations. What about dynamic or counter-cyclical capital requirements? Is pro-cyclicality a problem which has origins that are inherent in the banking system, or is it indeed institutions themselves operating as a herd? That's roughly what the pro-cyclicality question is all about. Mike Barker's paper talks about control theory, and that's a version of the control theory concept in the financial sector. Have actuaries more to contribute to this problem than other professionals? And I want to go back to my thesis, which I now repeat, that the distinguishing features of successful regulatory regimes are firstly regulatory agency structure. I put up the where the US is really a major issue right now. And secondly, effective supervision or surveillance of individual institutions. If the profession had built a position in the banking industry, it would undoubtedly now be playing a major part in the pro-cyclicality debate. And yet if my thesis is right, that debate is less important than many are suggesting. And what I want to put to you in this on this slide is that the qualitative aspects, if you like, of supervision are a really important aspect in this feedback loop, and some of the pro-cyclicality effects, I believe, in Australia have been mitigated by the fact that the supervisory activities have been as strong as they have been for as long as they have been. They were well in place before this crisis started. Well, with the profession having a dominant position in life insurance and general insurance, but not in banking, what are the capabilities needed to have such a position? No new skills, I don't believe, but we do need new knowledge, new experience. We need to build an established position, and we need some pioneers to do that. The effects of the profession's spokesman are quite valuable, people like Tony Coleman and Mike Barker, but it needs more than that. For ERM, it may contribute, but we need more domain experience as a profession. Specialist understanding and acceptance, not so much of skills, but of the professional role. So the good news, perhaps, is that one consequence of the GFC is that it has exposed limited quantitative and analytical skills and perhaps limited risk management understanding amongst many people operating in the financial sector, and that is probably an opening for actuarial expertise. So the challenge is how to achieve the acceptance. And this is the going for gold that I'm talking about. Going for gold is getting full acceptance in the banking industry to contribute to things like the pro-cyclicality debate, provisioning and so on. For experienced actuaries, that's a marketing and sales challenge. For less experienced actuaries, I think it's all about taking a role in the banking industry and then seeing if your professional background can really make a difference. Well, let me finish by saying, firstly, why is it that the history of actuaries in insurance is what it is, but we don't have the same history in banking? My thesis is that the prudential role and the role of the actuary in insurance are similar, because both parties are trying to protect the inverse cycle of production, whereby premiums are paid in advance and the cost of production, which is the claims, are paid later. That is, we're both trying to ensure that the promises to pay claims are honoured. In the banking system, however, the prudential role is about managing the mismatching, which is an actuarial description, or, as the bankers call it, the maturity transformation, where they basically borrow short and lend long. In the banking industry, the central bank is the safety valve, because it is a lender of last resort and so it's the safety valve. Balance sheet management is less obviously a risk management challenge in banking. And in insurance, the actuary protects the promises that insurance companies make, but arguably in banking, the central banker is protecting those promises. Well, let me finish by just referring again to the to going for gold for actuaries. I think it is trying to participate in this properly and fully in this banking debate that is so much at the heart of the financial system questions that are around. And let me just mention too that the main international insurance regulatory and supervisory agenda in this environment relates to group supervision, including capital and solvency, risk management and governance, including remuneration and accounting standards. And in banking, it's the same thing, but it also includes liquidity and pro-cyclicality. So going for gold is, I think, in the regulatory area is about getting good quality supervision as well as regulation happening in all major economies, with a huge challenge for the United States and in and for the actuarial profession. I think it is getting your oar in or our oar in a very constructive way into this pro-cyclicality capital management system stability debate. Thanks very much.